The Pat Kenny Show
on News Talk with Mastercard.
While speaking at the McGill Summer School recently, my next guest said that frontline staff in the health service are afraid of practicing medicine. Dr. Rona Mahoney, Master of the National Maternity Hospital, said that staff are worried how an adverse outcome will be treated in the media. And Rona Mahoney is with me in studio. Good morning and welcome, Rona.
Thank you.
So just give us some scenarios here whereby people are afraid maybe to do the right thing and they take the precautionary principle of doing less than they might because of the risks involved in maybe trying to save a life.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a broad issue. Obviously, I come from a particular area of obstetrics, which is, on the one hand, absolutely wonderful. I mean, it's wonderful to deliver a baby and it's wonderful to have a very complicated case and for a mum and baby to come through that. But it is very complicated and you have a unique physiology in obstetrics. You have a mother and a baby. You're trying to balance two lives. And you have very significant inherent complication, for example, hemorrhage, the effect that sepsis will have, thromboembolic disease. And these are all part and parcel of babies and delivering babies. But this can be very difficult, you know, and increasingly you're facing into a long shift on call and you will have cases referred from all over the country. They'll be very complicated. 3 o'clock in the morning is a very lonely place. You know, when you're in theatre, you might be 2 litres down, a patient is still bleeding. The team are well trained, we're all there. But you know, at the same time that you could have potentially maternal death or you could have very serious maternal morbidity. You deeply want everything to go wonderfully because you're looking at a new life coming into the world. You're looking at a young woman. But you're up against it sometimes. And I think it's very important that we do support staff. We have a very punitive environment in Ireland and we have a very adverse medical legal system. You know, we look at claims last year, 1.6 billion in terms of medical negligence claims paid out by the State Claims Agency in 2016, a 23% increase on the year before. You have medical counsel, you have coroner's court, you have the court of media, if you like. And Ireland is quite unique in the way that we present things in media. We have very intimate detail, both of patients and sometimes of doctors presented.
Well, we saw the Charlie Gard case in Britain where they did that kind of thing. But
it's
as you
unusual.
Say, it's unusual enough. I mean, people will go to media very quickly, won't they? But then sometimes you can point to hospitals and administrations who take years to finally apologise on the steps of the court before the case begins?
I think the legal system is very tardy, and I've said it before. I think generally doctors have no problem in admitting straight off what happens, but you can find yourself then in a very complex legal process. And really, that can be very slow in terms of all the different reports being compiled and the processes there. And I do think we need a better way, particularly we look like cases like cerebral palsy, which can take years. You know, I've always said it, you know, family has the devastation and the individual has the devastation of that outcome. Causation is very complex and yet we fight it out in the High Court over years and we spent the last, you know, 30 years looking at CTG and cerebral palsy. CTG is a pulse rate, it's a heartbeat. But that's all. And we're looking for complex causation with that very simple test. And maybe it should have dawned on us by now. We're not going to find the causation of cerebral palsy through CTG.
So what should happen if parents are given a cerebral palsy child as a result of something that happens?
Every child, every time. What you need is care. The primary consideration should be that every child...
Is that the first step?
Absolutely. The first step should be that every individual has the required care. But we also have to look at the other side, and that is, as we're talking about staff, you know, we have, if you look at BMJ figures, a third to a half of medical staff are feeling some symptoms of direct burnout. You know, in the recent BMJ study of Irish consultants, 93% feeling stressed, largely due to inadequate facilities, inadequate resources, having to see large volumes of patients in a short time, not being able to give the care they'd like to give, and overall lack of feeling of good management where there's long-term healthcare planning and where there's clear roads mapped out in terms of service delivery.
Going back to the people who actually feel scared to practice what they know, can you give me some examples of where they might be hesitant to do something they should do?
I think
a general example rather than specific.
No, I think we'll always do what we have to do. It's not at that stage, but there is an awareness, as I said, facing into a call, for example. If you chat to the gang coming on call, there will be a sense of, I hope nothing awful happens tonight. Of course you do. But there is that sense when there's an adverse outcome as well of, you can be very fearful of how that might be presented. the primary consideration is always the care that you give to a patient, and that must come first. But it's very interesting looking at attrition rates. You know, we've lost a number of really good registrars from obstetrics in the last couple of years, and one of their primary concerns has been that obstetrics is just too challenging. The inherent adverse outcomes are very difficult to deal with, and they don't feel that they're supported in Ireland to take on such high risk, and therefore they feel their life would be better without such high risk. And that worries me. And, you know, we meet every morning at 7:30 after night on call. And, you know, registrars, young doctors, they're young people, very clever, working very hard, working very long hours. They get tired. And then there is those feelings of burnout, low self-worth, feeling that they're not performing the way they should be feeling, kind of emotional exhaustion. And there can also be a real trauma when they have an adverse outcome. And, you know, it's interesting talking it out first thing in the morning. It's interesting the effect that it can have, you know.
When we're talking about, you know, two lives, the baby and the mother, or babies sometimes, multiple births, you know, is there a kind of an irresponsible attitude taken that these doctors, these young registrars, can actually work those hours and still be on the ball?
We all work long hours. I mean, the consultants are working very long hours as well.
I mean,
well,
is that something that maybe you should be banging the fist on the table and saying, we cannot go on doing this? Why do you think certain things may have happened? Because everyone was absolutely falling down with tiredness.
I mean, we've really increased the number of registrars and junior doctors in the hospital. So now we're compliant. Hollis Street is pretty much 100% compliant with working time directive. And I think that's been a brilliant initiative, because when I was training, we didn't have that. We had very small numbers. And so now it's great to see that that's something the hospital has been able to achieve. But that's because we've had a degree of autonomy to achieve that. We don't have the same autonomy at consultant level, you know, and we know that Ireland has the lowest number of obstetricians in the OECD. This figure is, we talk about this day in, day out. It is very difficult in Ireland to actually get through the process of appointing a new consultant. I think we should have consultants in-house on call 24 hours at National Maternity Hospital, because we are a tertiary hospital. We're dealing with a lot of complex cases from all over the country, and yet getting your application through the system, through the consultant appointment unit, actually is a really lengthy process. It's completely hidden.
So what you're saying is that there should be someone actually in-house, on-site, sleeping in a bed upstairs perhaps, or a bunk, whatever it might be, but they're there for that emergency.
Absolutely.
And that doesn't happen at the moment.
At the moment, we have 24/7 cover. So we're there. We can be in 5-10 minutes, and we're generally in very quickly. But I think it'll be a lot better. I mean, I was fascinated when I was on my Eisenhower Fellowship, you know, traveling around different hospitals in the US, you know, and they would have two consultants on call at night, four registrars, and these would be in hospitals delivering 6,000 babies. Very different approach, and I think it'll be better all round, because of course you have the peer support as well of being on call with a team, a bigger team, and I think it'll just be much healthier.
I mean, you do have, as I know personally, you've got lab staff 24.
We do, absolutely.
You have, obviously, midwives are there constantly and all of that kind of thing, but not the consultants.
Absolutely. So we're there, we're available, we're called in, but we're still working a full week and our call is on top of that. So again, and we're in a lot. I suppose these days the tendency for us is to come in, and quite right, and we will be in according to patient demand. So when a patient needs us, we're in, and we're there. But in a busy hospital like that, that means we're in a lot, and then you've also got your working week. Okay. So
now, suppose you do manage to get sanction for five more consultants, five more obstetricians.
Eight.
You need eight. Okay, suppose you get. Yeah. What's the difficulty in recruiting them then? So, is it the money? Is it the oppressive environment that such a small building will inflict upon people trying to work there, or what?
I think it's really interesting. I mean, on the one hand, I think that obstetrics is probably the best career you can have. It is an amazing job. And it is so tangible. You know, you get to deliver your baby every day, and you see these extraordinary outcomes. And we've seen extraordinary development in our specialty. I mean, we've never produced better outcomes. I mean, it's kind of a paradox that we have such rising litigation at a time when we've never produced such great outcome. But when we're looking at recruitment in Ireland, we have tended to focus only on remuneration, but we don't look at terms and conditions. And what young doctors really want. I mean, they want to practice in a hospital that is really going somewhere, that is going to deliver expert care, that is going to invest in the delivery of healthcare, where they are going to fulfil their potential as doctors. So we see the frustration among surgeons, you know, in this country who can't operate because theatres are closed. That is not what young doctors want. They want to develop their career. They want to make a huge contribution to patients. They want to make a huge contribution to medicine. And at the moment in Ireland, we really need to look at this. You know, we have 400 vacancies at consultant level. 200 of these are filled by locum, and we have some.
That's 400 vacancies, if you like, of the establishment figure that is there.
Of about 3,000 approved posts in the country, there are 4,000 vacancies. These are IHCA. 4,000. These are 400 vacancies. These are IHCA figures.
What I'm saying, though, is that we actually need more. I mean, no, for example, we need more neurologists.
Absolutely.
So that number has not been sanctioned. We're only talking about the posts that cannot be filled that are already sanctioned.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So we are grossly underpopulated with expertise.
And yet we're paying a lot of money in Ireland. So I think it comes back to the issues of why in our health service are we paying so much money, and yet why do we feel we have such gap and such deficiency? And yet in other areas, we do so well. You know, and actually, there's a lot of great things about healthcare, a lot of great outcome. But what we have, our problem really, I think, is infrastructure. We have a very old infrastructure, you know, and if we go back to the history of it, our hospital system has been a bit of an accident. You know, it grew up from the 1700s, the parliamentary grants, the beginning of the voluntary hospital system, on into the fever hospitals from cholera and TB, to the hospitals formed by the religious orders, Catholic Emancipation, to the famine hospitals, to the county homes. So we've had this really chaotic development of hospitals, largely through charitable institutions.
And the HSE was supposed to pull all of that together.
Exactly. But you know the political pressure. We've got 49 acute hospitals in this country. We have a population of 4.7 million. That is a very generous allocation of hospital. But
try to tell some politician we're going to close down your acute.
Exactly. I mean, we saw, you know, Tullamore. We see even the difficulties over Port Laois, the ability to make those really difficult decisions. And when you think of our acute hospital, you know, we have like some 2.4 acute hospital beds per 1,000 population. But even those beds don't really reflect the picture because, of course, each acute hospital is a combination of a kind of a GP service, casualty department, real emergency medicine department. You have your acute admissions, you have your elective surgery. And then, of course, we have the big problem of our long stay patients. So many of our elderly patients who don't actually require acute hospital care, they need enabling services, step down care,
even in the community.
Absolutely. And that's a totally different care requirement for them. And so they're not being served well by being in an acute hospital. You know, just to say, I'm not going to claim to be able to cure the health service. I mean, you know, and I know that would be a rather arrogant claim. But there's a few things we need to do. I call it PACE. So the first is disease prevention. The next is timely access to care and appropriate care, competent care, and then striving to consistently enhance our experience and our outcome. So look about prevention. First of all, think about it. And we have moved from sort of acute episodic care to chronic care in most Western health systems. So in other words, people are living longer. And we look at our own population trends. I mean, you know, we have so much population now that is over 65, occupying 50% of our beds. Most of the diseases we see in chronic medicine have huge impact by lifestyle. So we look at alcohol in excess, we look at smoking, we look at lack of exercise, we look at obesity, we look at drug addiction, and all of these things, stress, have a huge impact
on chronic disease. If we change all of that now in a younger cohort, the benefits of that won't flow through for a couple of decades. Do you know what I mean?
But
if you've got someone who's got type 2 diabetes, who has already damaged their circulation, their eyesight or whatever, it's too late.
Of course, but we have to start. I mean, there is already Healthy Ireland. I mean, there are initiatives there, but this is something we've really got to embrace because it doesn't make any sense to me to plan a health service around expensive medication and expensive treatment.
Next thing, the timely access to care. The waiting lists.
Yeah, I mean, if we look at that, we see that we have, you know, 12% increase in waiting lists for outpatient appointments, 15% increase in waiting lists for surgical procedure, an increase of 58% of people treated on trolleys in emergency department since 2012. We see the difficulties in the mental health services, and all of these are telling us a story about access. So in other words, the acute hospitals are really struggling to provide access, and that is largely, as I said, an infrastructural issue, and as we've discussed, the fact fact that each acute hospital is kind of four hospitals in one. So the beds that are there, the acute beds, the 2.4 per thousand, in fact, are not there to provide that acute care. Okay.
So acute hospitals should be doing acute business.
Exactly. So we've got to build up our community service where we can deal with a certain amount of the diagnostics.
Yeah, but we close down all those cottage hospitals.
But we've got to look at this again, and we've got to build up an infrastructure within the community. Ireland has never built up our community service. We've always been hospital centric, and there's so much of the basic diagnostics that can be done in community that would take a huge amount of pressure from the hospitals. And we've got to create those step down facilities, and particularly facility for care of the elderly.
Okay, now the competence of care, I think we can almost say that is a given, because by and large people will tell you every time we do something, once I got my father in, it was great. You know, so I think by and large, medical professionals in Ireland are admired and trusted. But the outcomes then, our outcomes, how are they?
Yeah, so I mean, obstetrics is interesting. We've been producing our outcomes, you know, for 100 years. Every year we produce an annual report, we produce our clinical outcomes, and we look at our trends. Not all hospitals do that. This is a relatively new area in healthcare in Ireland. And it's great to see we're now starting to look at outcome in HSE hospitals as well, because up to now, we haven't been producing outcomes there. You cannot practice medicine and without knowing outcome. And in relation to competence, people want to come and see a trained doctor, midwife, clinician. And while we have an excellent number of trained staff, if we look at the medical staff, the doctors, we have so many NCHDs who are in training. So if you look at our public system, the majority of doctors in our public system are doctors
trainees.
In training. Whereas people want to come and see a trained doctor.
Yeah.
And one of the big reasons I think why people choose private healthcare is that they want access. They want to see a trained doctor, and perhaps they want better accommodation. And in our public system, we have got to start to compete with that. People need to come to our public hospitals and see consultants,
doctors. So for Tony O'Brien, I mean, you're saying that it's actually not quite simple to fix, but certainly it's quite simple to lay out where we need to go. In other words, I would hear from various people, ophthalmologists or neurologists, and they'd be saying, we don't have enough consultants, right? So for Tony O'Brien and his people to say, okay, for Ireland, this is what we need. These are the number of neurologists. These are the number of ophthalmologists. These are the number of gynecologists and obstetricians, et cetera, et cetera. And then start working toward those targets.
Absolutely. But we've also got to design the infrastructure of that service. So the acute hospital doing the acute work. We're diluting consultants across 49 hospitals. So we're
diluting
skill sets.
Some of them don't have enough work to do in where they are.
Exactly.
And others are overrun.
Exactly. So we've got to streamline the whole thing so that we have a concentration of consultants and specialist consultants and quaternary centres. So the idea and then we need to look at transport. We cannot bring hospitals to everyone in the country. We have to start getting people to hospitals. And when you look at, you know, the setup in Canada and Australia and the kind of transport that's available there, you see how you can run large specialist centres. We also need to look at campus care. We need to look at our acute medical care delivered in a campus setting where you have a wide breadth and depth of service available to patients all in the one location, and where you have that whole interaction between the different specialties.
Now, I know people listening in will say, well, look, the problem is we've got a two-tier system. We've got the insurance-led system, and we have the public system. If only we had one system and poured all the money into that, which means that everyone who's paying for health insurance would have to pay that amount of money in tax. But it would be more evenly spread, I suppose. Would that work? I mean, could we make that transition easily, or are we too far gone? Are we too complicated to actually make it just one service for all?
No, I think it's an unassailable aspiration. The idea that people will access healthcare on the basis of clinical need and not on the basis
of
economy.
That's what we should have.
That's what we should have. It's unassailable. And once you acknowledge that that's where you want to go, it is just a question then of working out the steps, how you get there. Like, it's not complex, and there will be kind of transitional funding required. But the answer is to build up our public system. You know, if you look at previous health policy, you know, about 15 years ago, we were co-locating private hospitals with public hospitals to sort of take the heat out of the public system. But of course, then you're allowing private medicine cherry pick the high volume, low risk care that generates income. But the hospitals, public hospitals, are left dealing with the expensive,
I mean,
specialised
comment
care.
Here. Stress consultants maybe take on less patients and be more conscientious with the ones they have. Recently paid €200 to see a gynaecologist, €180 to see a urologist. Lucky if you get 10 minutes with either of them. It's shocking. And that whole question of you know, private and public under the one roof, as you have in the National Maternity Hospital, people see it's a methodology for allowing the top people the consultants to coin it.
Yeah, there's always this accusation. But of course, we don't have a private obstetric hospital in Ireland. And in fact, you can't have private obstetrics really in Ireland because the cost of litigation is so prohibitive. I don't think we'll ever see a private obstetric hospital. At the moment, under the Health Act and under the consultant contract, provision is made for private practice. And that's just a fact, whether people like it or not in Ireland. I think the issue is, how do we get to a one-tier system where people access care and don't need to opt for private practice?
I mean, do you think that when you get out to the new campus in St. Vincent's in Elm Park, that you could offer a service there that would be so good that no one would bother with private practice?
I think that's always the aspiration. Of course, the new hospital will be built in such a way that every patient will have a private room. So straight off, the design of the hospital is such that it gives everyone that kind of a quality of accommodation.
But will you have
care.
The numbers? Because if you want to see for antenatal examinations and so on, you want to see many people go private, and you know, gynecologists and obstetricians make a good living from their private patients, but at the end of the day they're delivered by a publicly paid midwife.
But in the design of the hospital, private care hasn't been an issue. The whole design of the hospital is about the provision of services for patients, providing the facilities that will deliver 10,000 babies. Private medicine is not a consideration in terms of the design of the hospital, nor in the future aspiration for service division or provision. It's all about service provision. The issue of private practice is really a matter for government policy. It is provided for within our Health Act at the moment of 1970 and provided for within consultant contract. I think the big issue, if you stop private practice tomorrow, that's fine, but you have to provide the capacity in the public system, because at the moment we know that about 700 million of income is generated for hospitals, public hospitals, through private patients being treated in the hospitals. But on top of that, we know that there's probably a few billion in running the private hospitals in Ireland. Now, if you create a system where people don't need to go private, those patients will need to be able to come into the public system and access the care.
But
so at the end of the day, you come back all the time to service provision, Pat. How do you provide services to all of our country to be able to come to our hospitals, access consultant delivered care, where they see people trained in the area, where they have good accommodation, they have access and they can get there? And that is a matter of providing capacity for the service, and that must be the primary consideration.
But to what extent do the consultants in your area of expertise enjoy a very good income because of their private practice versus what's, you know,
is that really how we want to think about designing a state-of-the-art health service, you know, whether or not consultants are paid or not? The point is, how do we provide the services that are going to deliver the best care to patients?
I'm just wondering, would they head off to more attractive jobs in the United States or wherever if they didn't have that private income? Would they depart?
The private income's there at the moment, but we're having a huge difficulty recruiting consultants. So something is wrong. Perhaps consultants think further than simply remuneration. Perhaps it is the terms and conditions of their future career that are terribly important. We see young consultants going all over the world, often at great financial cost themselves, to train, to get skills they can bring back. I think young doctors want to work in a really dynamic, vibrant health system that is going to be about service delivery and about achieving their potential as doctors.
In the new hospital, I mean, will it be so good, because now's the time to get it right at the design stage, will it be so good that people could actually say, well, I'll go public and I'll have just as good a time as I would have if I went private?
Completely. That's the whole point.
And will they have nice consulting rooms, like the private consulting rooms, which will be on site as well? Would I not be able to tell the difference?
The hospital will be magnificent. I mean, for the first time in Dublin, we will have a modern, fit-for-purpose, tertiary hospital. But not only will it be magnificent in terms of its infrastructure for every patient coming, but it will be co-located on a campus. And what we will be doing is providing women with access to all of the medical, diagnostic, surgical facility on campus. So in terms of service provision, we will be hugely expanding the services available.
But I'm just wondering, would I be able to tell the difference? You know, remember Mary Harney famously, left, turn right.
No, you won't.
If I turn left or right, will I go into a consulting room and it'll be exactly the same?
Private medicine has not been a consideration remotely in the design of this hospital. It is about designing a state-of-the-art hospital that's going to provide the best possible care to women, and in a campus setting that opens up a whole range of service available to women. So this is a hospital that will be able to look after the most complex pregnancies in this country, look after babies in a way that we're just not seeing in Dublin, and accommodation will be the same no matter who you are.
Okay, this one. I'm 33 weeks pregnant with twins. I'm attending Holles Street. I'm there every fortnight. I've only seen the consultant consultant twice. The outpatient area is like a third world waiting area. Mostly I'm there 3 to 4 hours to see the midwife for 2 minutes and a registrar for 3 minutes. Terrible seating and organisation for heavily pregnant women.
Mm. I'm the first to say it. National Maternity Hospital is not fit for purpose. I said it day one when I came in as master. I walked around the hospital my first week. I took photographs of the facilities and right down to things like not enough bathrooms, not an appropriate facility for women in 2017. You know, I think women deserve and our babies deserve so much better. There's nothing more important than being born. And every single one of us is born. And as a society, we've got to invest in that. It really matters. And I'm really excited that we're going to have a new hospital for women that is actually going to be state of the art for all women.
In terms of governance and all the rest, that has been sorted. So the, ethically and so on, there'll be no. The ownership thing, I mean, I know the government will have a lien on the hospital and all the rest. Has that issue been finally thrashed out?
Yeah,
because people just say, we're paying for the hospital as taxpayers. Why should we just hand it over? I mean, even if we'll never kind of use it.
But the taxpayers are, we're a voluntary hospital. So in fact, the Earl of Pembroke owns Hall Street at the moment, but this isn't obviously a beneficial ownership. These are all just technical ownerships. But what the taxpayer...
And who'll get the proceeds from the building when it's
sold? Yeah, so we would plan to actually sell the building and that would be given to the HSE and that would be folded into the new development. So.
Okay.
When our hospital was founded by its founders, the charter demands that the assets, if you like, are in a way owned by women. It can only be used, and the asset can only be used if it's sold to provide maternity services for women and infants. And that's exactly what will happen. So this will be a really good collaboration. I mean, what you're looking at here, I think, is in many ways the future for our healthcare development. We have a hybrid system of voluntary hospital and of hospitals run and funded by the HSE. We operate with the HSE under service arrangement. In other words, they buy service off National Maternity Hospital under service arrangement and they get very good value, I believe, in terms of the taxpayers' money, and that's very important. When we move, at the moment, the plans, the operations will move exactly as are. We will provide all the same services and, in fact, more service. I think the ultimate arrangement will be that the state will own the building, and that's fine. The ownership is a very technical thing of the building.
Yeah.
It's the control of the service, if you like, and the ability to run the service with that expertise and the ability for women and maternity services to have control of the budget so they can control staff and budget. And that's been a big problem in Ireland, where we see the HSE hospitals, where there's no direct control of budget for women and infants within these large acute adult setup. So this is a big step forward in terms of the way forward for running maternity service.
Just a couple of comments to finish. As a recently retired GP, I'm weary of being lectured by consultants about bed management. I became sick of sending acute appendices, intestinal obstructions and acute medical problems to A&Es because there are no acute beds for them to be admitted to. It doesn't matter what level of community medicine you develop, people still become acutely ill. It ain't rocket science. Great to hear Rona talking such sense in relation to community-based approach as in Europe. I'm due my baby on Saturday in the National Maternity Hospital. Competence and people-based skills of all staff has been excellent, but waiting in outpatient's clinic has been up to 5 hours. Also, the lack of use of technology at both admin and medical levels is frightening. Use of paper-based files and chalk and talk of maternity education. Are we for real in this country?
That's fascinating. We're moving.
Because Cork and Kerry have gone digital.
They've moved to digital. So are we. We're going live probably early next year. But it's interesting, the maternity neonatal digital programme is fantastic. But we need a national IT infrastructure that all talks to each other. We have so many different IT programs that don't talk to each other. Like, it's a mess. And while it's brilliant to see the maternity program rolling out and going paperless and very exciting, this needs to happen at national level so that all the systems are talking to each other.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Rona. It'll be great to watch the transition from Hollis Street out to Elm Park. Estimated time? ETA?
Well, you know, really the next step is on board Planola, and I don't want to second guess them. So the planning permission is really the next big step. So hopefully that will be autumn time. Then you're into contracting. So yeah, we could be building by next year.
Rona Mahoney, Master of the National Maternity Hospital in Hollis Street. Thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
on News Talk with MasterCard.